We know hunting for good coffee can be frustrating and time-consuming. And with all the confusing labels out there, it's hard to know that what you are buying is actually mindfully sourced and truly making a difference in people's lives. That's why we put together our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription. Over the last 15 years, Joe Bean Coffee has built friendships with award-winning coffee farmers, ones we trust to consistently bring us amazing coffee year after year. Coffee tastes best at the peak of harvest, which is why we run our program like a CSA, regularly sending you a rotating selection of in-season coffee. You pick how many bags and how often you need it. We do the rest. And you can feel good knowing you're directly supporting small-scale coffee farmers. Go to JoeBeanRoasters.com for details.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today, and may the fourth be with you. Actually, you know what? I'm such a fraud. I'm not allowed to say that. I don't even know what it means. I know it's Star Wars or Star Trek, but I don't know the difference between the two, and so just excuse me. I'll take that one back. Anyway, happy Sunday. How does that work? Yes. For me, good weekend. Make-A-Wish Gala last night. I was the MC. Full disclosure, I'm recording this before that even happened, so I'm going to just go ahead and assume it was a wonderful event last night. Lots of money raised for a great cause. In all honesty, it is a great cause. I love Make-A-Wish. I think you really just, and as a people pleaser, you know, that's me, as a people pleaser, nothing better than making someone's wish come true. I am signed up to be a wish granter. I am, however, allowing my Rotary presidency to come to an end prior to granting some wishes through Make-A-Wish, but I went through the process, the orientation, the background check, all that to do that. And I'll start doing it like this fall, because Rotary presidency is up June 30th, and I get a bunch of time back when that happens. And I do believe a certain amount of my time needs to be allocated to serving my community. What is the percent? I don't know. I'd say probably in the last year it's been more than it needed to be, but I was called to serve as Rotary president, and I don't regret a moment of it. However, you know, there's probably a percent in there somewhere, and I need to land on what it is. You know, a lot going on. Lot going on, busy calendar, and really had a good week this week work-wise. And, in fact, we're going to talk quite a bit of work and business and stuff in just a couple of minutes. But really good week this week work-wise. Had a couple of days with hours and hours to dedicate to the growth of my business. And, you know, there's some weeks that come and go where I just feel like I didn't have a lot of time to invest in that. And other weeks, like this week, where I did have a lot of time to invest in that. And it just, there is no denying the feeling is better. The feeling is better. There's a euphoric feeling. There is a, I think I talk about it all the time, a forward momentum that I feel when I'm able to dedicate an adequate amount of time to growing the business, or at least to putting my energy towards growing the business. You know, there's some sayings about, you know, today's sacrifice leads to tomorrow's reward, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. You're doing a lot of work that you don't see immediate results for, but you're just kind of irons in the fire. You know what I mean? You're just putting irons in the fire, and yeah, it's life, it's business. Not all irons that have been put in the fire are going to come to fruition, but they don't come to fruition at all if you don't, you know, make yourself available, right? Got to file an application if you want to get the job. So we are going to talk a lot of business today. I do just want to say one thing. There was a news Friday morning of this week that the President Trump has signed an executive order to end funding to NPR and PBS. there's kind of been a lot of debate over whether or not they are federally funded to begin with. There's a small percentage, I think, of direct federal funding that goes into public broadcast. However, there has been stuff that I've seen, and listen, I am so sorry. I don't know. I've not done a proper amount of investigative research into this, but I have seen stuff that shows that it's actually, what do you call them, NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are receiving federal funding that are then turning that federal funding into funding opportunities for NPR and PBS. So I think that if federal funding is cut off, that it will hurt them, is what I'm trying to say. I think that there's been some narrative that, oh, it's of such a small percentage, but I do think it would hurt NPR. And of course, in Rochester, we have just a treasure in WXXI, an absolute just local treasure, a iconic institution in WXXI. And over the years, WXXI has snatched up a couple of other iconic local properties, right? The Little Theater, City Magazine. You know, it's just, it's really good. Now, I'll say that I think that it would be an absolute tragedy to see those things go away. I even think the programming and content that they create, to see it diminished in any way, to see it pulled back, to see less of it, I think would also be really devastating. I do want to be fair. I want to be fair, and I want to say I get that they are liberal-leaning, and I see it. I think it's not a secret that they are all very liberal-leaning organizations, WXXI, The Little, City. I don't think they would deny that. I have heard a little, you know, I'm a big Connections fan, Evan Dawson. I listen almost every week to probably three-quarters of the episodes that they put out. I've heard some claims that, you know, we call it down the middle, we let all sides be represented. They certainly do allow all voices to be heard and all sides to be represented, but the lean is, it would be really hard to deny that the lean isn't left on the show and the station. And if this gets me into some sort of big debate or fight, I'm really sorry. Listen, for what it's worth, personally, I'm here for it, but I understand that it could be argued, it should probably be argued, that if something's going to be subsidized by the government, it really shouldn't have a lean in either direction. And of course, that's a big conversation, right? That could go far beyond talking about broadcast radio, broadcast television, online platforms, things like that. I mean, that's a big conversation to have. It's not something we're going to have right here, right now. And frankly, it's not something I'm even qualified or informed enough to have. But I understand the notion that partisan politics probably shouldn't be federally funded. We'll put it that way. That does make sense to me. For as much as I am a fan, I am here for it. And I think that each and every one of those properties is a local treasure and institution, and anything to harm them just tears at me. Just hurts bad. So, okay, let's get into it. Let's talk a little business today. I got some feedback last week. Multiple pieces of feedback that they liked the beginning. You guys liked the beginning of the podcast where I told you that I had asked ChatGPT what I should talk about, and it spit some good topics at me. I also mentioned that I had episodes coming up with Sean McCarthy, who of course you heard from last week, and then also Alyssa Belasco from New York Kitchen. She unfortunately had to cancel and reschedule, and we'll get Alyssa on in the future, but this episode would have been the Alyssa episode. And I needed a topic, so I did it again. I went to ChatGPT, and my prompt was, please review the entire history of the Pauly Guglielmo podcast and let me know what you think I should cover on my next monologue episode. I made zero edits, and I have two pieces of paper in front of me with a whole bunch of topics. And they break into a few categories. There's trending and timely. There's entrepreneurial insight. There's inside the industry. And there's guest-driven, which actually guest-driven we'll probably skip, because basically guest-driven, it's saying, consider inviting another entrepreneur onto the show and also consider telling the stories of local business owners, founders, and proprietor. So honestly, that is what most of the episodes are. So I'll kind of skip that. But anyway, as for topicality, under trending and timely, made in the USA, is domestic manufacturing back? Well, listen, talking about politics, right? I mean, this is the whole push on tariffs. Tariffs is something that is causing temporary pain, but the idea is, hey, if we could survive, I don't know, a half a decade, then in theory it would bring a bunch of manufacturing back domestically, which would just make us better as a nation in general. It would increase opportunities for better, higher paying jobs. It would lower prices in the long run because more things would be being made domestically. And in general, is domestic manufacturing back? Well, I think that's one of the biggest questions going right now in our country. I can tell you in food, in regards to my business specifically, food, condiments, bottled sauce, food manufacturing is very strong in the United States. Now, it's also strong in many other countries. It's, in general, the food industry is somewhat low-hanging fruit in the sense that, you know, everyone's got to eat. Your desire to eat or your need to eat is not going to be replaced by AI. Perhaps the manufacturing of your food will be, but there is no way to substitute your appetite. So, for as long as we live, food will be required. Now, domestically, as I mentioned, there's a lot of food production opportunity. However, I will say what we do at Kraft Cannery, small-scale manufacturing, that is a little bit harder to find. What happens is when you think about food manufacturing is it breaks down into so many categories. So if you think about how micro it can get, think about just my business, Kraft Cannery, right? It's liquids, sauces, condiments in glass bottles and or plastic jugs in the amount of anywhere between 25 gallons and about 2,500 gallons per day. That's pretty narrow. Who fits in that? Who fits in there is pretty narrow. Now, there's plenty of business. There's customers, but that's a narrow thing. And what you find as you look through food manufacturers is that they've all narrowed down into what we call core competencies. And so when you do set out to find food manufacturing on behalf of your brand, you are often looking for somebody who specializes in the thing that you do. And it's very narrow. It's very niche. So as much as there's a lot of food manufacturing, there are deserts and valleys all over the place in food manufacturing in this country. So next topic, the food business in 2025, trends, tech, and taste. Talk AI in food production, clean label expectations, and niche customer demands. So AI in food production in my small-scale factory really isn't here yet. The ways we are implementing AI at my place is, one, is I'm just using ChatGPT as a personal assistant basically every day, but that's what everyone's doing. The one way I would say that really you're going to see us implement some AI is that we had an intern this year who's only got about 2 more weeks with us. Wonderful lady named Marilyn from the Golisano Institute for Entrepreneurship who built us something we are calling SaucyBot. I don't know if that's what we'll actually call it when it rolls out, but we haven't rolled it out yet. We honestly are planning on rolling it out, though, by the end of May, so soon. And all it is something you've seen and experienced before from other businesses, which is it's essentially an answering service. So this thing will be able to answer your inquiries at our website, but in a conversational way. It'll know more information than most chat bots, I guess, or chat functions that you've been able to do previously on websites. It knows, it's reviewed our documents, and it's able to answer some questions. And we've also been able to tell it what is confidential information. We've been able to trigger it with, or not trigger it, but we've been able to program it with certain questions will trigger it to say, hey, that's confidential or that's proprietary. We need you to, you know, it's time for you to contact a human at Kraft Cannery. And so I really think that that's pretty interesting. And we're actually going to be talking about today. We're talking about also an phone answering service. Can we get the AI to actually answer the phone and then direct the conversation to one of our cell phones based on who the person's looking for, which I think would be really cool. So I would say bigger plants are probably using AI in way more interesting ways. AI that can perhaps see a problem coming. In manufacturing, your biggest issue is always going to be just if something happens that shuts you down. And anybody owns a factory, big or small, will tell you this happens all the time. things happen, things come up, all of a sudden your line stops running. If AI were somehow able to be keyed in on those trouble spots on your production line and able to give you the heads up that something needed help ahead of time instead of just following a traditional preventative maintenance schedule, I think that would be huge. Clean label expectations. Yeah, this has been a thing for quite a while. It's still a thing. It's interesting, you know, I was just having this conversation. I probably shouldn't tell you who I was having it with, but I was having it with somebody in Rochester who's launching a line of condiments, who's famous for a restaurant that is not very healthy. It's a restaurant that really, I don't think, has any healthy foods on their menu. And this guy and I were talking about a product he wants to put out that has preservative. It's going to require some preservative. And we were hemming and hawing over that because nobody likes to see preservative in a product. And sort of what we came up with was, you know, is a customer or a consumer coming to this menu concerned about preservative? Because, I mean, look at the menu, right? The menu is caloric, if you will. So clean label expectations still exist in many places, but not all places. I still think that there are plenty of people who are going to buy what they like. They understand that occasionally they're making sacrifices in terms of things that are in their food that they wish weren't. I mean, I know that I certainly do it, right? Like, of course it makes me feel better when something is clean label. Of course I will eat an Oreo if you hand it to me right now. Do you know what I mean? That's, I hate to say it, but probably most people. But I don't want to speak on your behalf, so I don't know. And then finally, the last thing it wanted me to talk about here was niche consumer demands. Yeah, this is kind of an old thing that also I've talked about quite a bit about. Is niche better or not? Because one of the things when I first started the sauce business and I was running around just trying to get my sauce everywhere in any store I could, was that I had going against me was that every store had a million sauces already. I was one of a gazillion. It was impossible to stand out. But one thing I did have going for me was the fact that nobody needs to be trained on how to use pasta sauce. There's no educating the consumer on how to use pasta sauce. Over the years, folks have come to us with niche ideas and niche products, and many times I've thought to myself, boy, you know, I'm really jealous, because the objection I always received was, hey, I already have a million pasta sauces, I don't need another one. And these guys won't have to deal with that. They won't have to deal with that because the thing they're walking into the store with is something that's one of a kind. It's unique. It's, nobody has this thing, right? That said, when something is actually too unique, the consumer has no idea what to do with it. You put it on a shelf and you're not there to explain, because everyone can explain why their product is awesome, but you can't stand next to your product in 100 stores all at the same time. You need to rely on that label to do the work for you. And if you're not able to convey the message of what this product is on a label pretty clearly, I mean, people really don't have a ton of attention span. You need to be able to convey what this product is in a matter of seconds, moments even. Or else, you know, people just move on. They move to the next thing. They don't know what that is. They just move to the next thing. They don't have a ton of time to think about it. So there's the disadvantage. The consumer is not educated on what it is. So niche products are around, of course, and they'll always be around. And they're a good idea. And a lot of really great products that you know and love today started as niche products. All I'm saying is it's not always amazing to be a niche product. It can be, but not always. Moving on with ChatGPT's suggestions on entrepreneurial insight, it's asking me to talk to you about From Sauce to Success, Turning a Recipe into a Brand. Share the behind the scenes of building a food business. Perfect for up-and-comers. You know, I was going to say, we do this all the time through these episodes with guests, but well, you know what, let me talk specific to Craft Cannery and just give you kind of a 30 to 60 second, how do you even get started? Because I get asked this all the time. People say, I don't even know how to get started. How would I even get started? It's pretty simple how to get started. You contact us, my contact information, paul@craftcannery.com. It's an email. First thing that's going to happen, I'm going to send you an NDA, confidentiality agreement. We're going to talk to each other about things that we don't want each other sharing, right? You have this cherished recipe that you don't want me to be able to share, and I have proprietary information about how we make our products, what kind of equipment we own, and our pricing structure that I don't want you to share. So we're going to sign a mutual NDA. After that, we will share information. You'll share your recipe, and we will take a look at it from two standpoints. One is procurement, which is, can we get the ingredients in your product? Can we get them here? And you might think, well, geez, that's pretty simple, bro. Like, why is that a question? Well, sometimes people are using old school at-home recipes. They're buying, you know, stuff from Walmart in little small cans that just isn't available in bulk, and it just doesn't lend itself easily to manufacturing. So we just have to talk through those conversations. How would we accomplish this using what we can get our hands on? And then after procurement and ingredients, recipe, then we talk process, which is, can we make it in the way that you want us to make it? Really good example of this would be that we have companies who will contact us and say, hey, I want to make a pasta sauce. My pasta sauce has to simmer for 8 hours before it can be bottled. And we will say to them, well, we'll say, you know, tying up 8 hours of kettle time is not ideal, and it's going to be pretty expensive. Can we talk through how we can achieve the flavor of a long, slow simmer without actually doing a long, slow simmer? So we're just going to talk through things. That's all. And then from that point on, we'll create a prototype. I'll quote you a price. We'll move on to regulatory, labels, then you're off and running. All in all, on average, about 3 months probably to go from I have an idea to I'm on the shelves. That's I would say, more geared towards the startups. The larger brands that we've dealt with, idea to shelf, can be as little as 6 months, can be as high as maybe even 18 months. It can kind of vary there. Next topic, co-packing confession. What brands don't know about outsourcing manufacturing, with some candid war stories. Ooh, I like this. Let's see what I can come up with. What brands don't know about outsourcing manufacturing. Okay, so let's piggyback on what I was just talking about. Here's maybe something. So, there are a million different places to get a million different types of ingredients. We have vetted our suppliers. We have negotiated our best prices, and we're bringing a lot of ingredients in bulk. So just to dive a little deeper into that and to tell a quote-unquote war story, oftentimes people will come to us with something. They've always made their product at home. They've always made it using such and such that they bought it off the shelf at whatever their favorite store is. And what we're trying to do here is we are constantly trying to gear everything back towards who are we? What suppliers do we trust? Who can we get the best price from? Who has the highest quality? How do we know we can do this our way with our ingredients while still achieving your desired outcome? And I would say that that's sort of the other side of that argument. The other thing that will happen is that I would say war stories is I'll share one with you that I shared with a friend actually just yesterday, because in our business in food manufacturing, I believe there's a lot of things that are proprietary, but one thing that shouldn't be proprietary is safety and references, employees and or clients who tend to hop from business to business, just kind of burning people, shouldn't be allowed to get away with that. And so yesterday there was a story where I talked to somebody about somebody else who had come out here, talked a big game. This is several years ago, by the way, but had come out here, talked a big game, and had placed an order with us. And the order required us to buy a lot of raw material, a lot of ingredients. And so we went out and we bought, you know, and I'm just going to round the numbers to make it simple, but let's say we bought $3,000 worth of raw materials, ingredients, to make this person's product. A few weeks go by, day comes to run the product, and the day before this to run the product, they reach out to us and say, hey, that order, you know what? Never mind. Well, I already have all the ingredients, my friend. You placed an order, and I bought everything I needed to create your order, and now I'm sitting here, and I'm kind of stuck. So how do you want to handle this? In other words, I'm not getting stuck with these ingredients right here, right? A lot of times, and so just to bring this back to the topic, the quote-unquote war stories, a lot of times when co-packers, when food manufacturers seem to be a little rigid about getting the exact thing you want to get, I can tell you that we talk to each other and not a single one of us does not have a story like that. We've all been screwed by somebody. In fact, it's not just a food manufacturer. I think this is all businesses. I think anytime you go to a business and you see a rule of some kind that you think is a little silly, just remember it probably exists because somebody made it. Somebody screwed it up for everybody. You know. All right. Bootstrapping versus big backing is the next topic. What it's like to grow a business with your own money versus with investors. I think that when a business is small, it doesn't make a lot of sense to bring on investors. A lot of us start our businesses. There's a lot of different ways to start a business. But really, I'm talking about from my own experience and the experience of most of the folks that we deal with. We're really starting micro businesses. I mean, there's small business, then there's micro business. And I don't know. I think micro business is described as essentially a business with zero employees and, you know, like under $100,000 in sales. And I might be a little off on that, but that's generally speaking, that's a micro business. And, that's how a lot of us start. Maybe not how all of us start. And, you know, I listen to How I Built This, one of my favorite entrepreneur podcasts. Plenty of businesses start out by, you know, creating an idea, a pitch deck, and then going out finding investors. That's a whole different path. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about you're going to launch a food brand, a sauce, a condiment, you know, a brand of some kind. Most folks are starting as micro businesses, in which case it just doesn't make a lot of sense to take on an investor. First of all, it takes a really, really long time to make any money doing this. I've been very, very upfront about this in the past. I started my business in 2014. I really didn't get a chance to take anything even resembling a livable wage out of it until about 2020. There was a little bit of money coming out of it between like 2018 and 2019, but nothing livable. And really, even in 2020, it was barely livable. The pivot to manufacturing was where that really changed. Manufacturing gave me the opportunity. I'd say it's been probably about 4 years, maybe three. I'm trying to remember exactly when, but 3 or 4 years now that I've been making not just a livable wage, probably about 3 years since a livable wage and about 2 years since I've been making what I would say a good wage. And that's, you know, God, you're talking about being 7 years into starting a food business before you really start to make a respectable wage. Now, you may go way bigger and faster and better than that. Plenty of people have done way, way better than that. That's just my experience. That's one guy moving at the speed that I moved, and that does not mean that it would be that way for everyone. But I just wanted to give you just one example of why I wouldn't take on investors early, because your business would only be worth, I mean, you start a micro business making pasta sauce and you do $10,000 in sales, I mean, you give away 50% of your business for $5,000. $5,000 might sound like a lot of money. It's not. It's really not a lot of money. It's certainly not enough to be giving up 50% of your business for. So I would say in a lot of cases, start without investors. And of course, there are exceptions to that. But all right, a few more topics. Inside the industry, what retailers really want. Insights on how buyers choose products for shelves and why packaging and pitch matter. Oh, this is great. This is really good. This is something I talk about. I think of what we've talked about several times on this podcast, but it's really what is more important, that the product be amazing, that the brand be amazing, that the pitch be amazing. Well, of course, in a perfect world, you want all three. But the most difficult of the three is the brand. Building the brand. Building an amazing brand with loyal followers is far harder, much more difficult than making an amazing product. It really, truly is. You have to have a good product. You can't have an amazing brand with a shitty product. That will not work. But I'm telling you, if you can have one be amazing and one be really good, have the amazing brand with the really good product. Because the amazing product with the really good brand, yeah, that's, yeah, I guess you still have a good chance at success that way. But brand is more difficult and long-term more important. I have seen a lot of really good products. I have seen a handful of really good brands. There's a lot of good products, not as many good brands. I don't know how many times I could say that, but I am telling you that's the case. People trust your brand, and you know, and you're, I don't want to say home free, but you're off to a really good start. As far as how buyers choose products, I'm not a buyer. I can't pretend to be one. I can speak on maybe a couple of behalves. Of course, my wife, mother-in-law, they own Redbird Market in Fairport. They are very friendly to startups, local businesses. There's a lot of businesses like that, a lot of really friendly local businesses. There is a rule, though, and I'll tell you this, is what they do at Redbird, and that is they are very sort of easy to sell a first case of product to. If you're brand new, they'll give anything a chance. First case, absolutely. But I will tell you this, second case, they're a lot more difficult. It's a lot more difficult to sell them a second case. They need to see that first case move in order to justify buying a second case. That second order is oftentimes the hardest one to get. You know, that's the little bit of experience I maybe have from a buyer's perspective. I would say that, you know, I would say that it's not exactly what this topic is asking, but, and it is something that has come up now a couple of podcasts in a row. It really started with the interview with Jess and Danny Berry, really even started with their appearance on WXXI, and that is that when people come and meet with a co-packer, with a contract manufacturer, that more often than not, it occurs to me that they don't realize this is a two-way interview. I deal with them all the time. I dealt with one yesterday. Brands, startups, really, micro businesses, you know, solopreneurs, whatever you want to call them, who are really trying to kind of put me on my heels. I can feel it. I can hear it in their tone. I can tell by the way they're talking that they don't realize manufacturing doesn't work that way. They kind of think, yeah, I've got a product, and I'll tell you what, if you can impress me, I'll let you make it for me as long as the price is right. And boy, is that a good way to blow a job interview that you don't even realize you're in when you're talking to your co-packer. You know, guy must have said on the phone four times, doesn't want to spend a lot of money. Doesn't want to be spending a lot of money. And I'm going, does he realize he's talking to somebody? My whole job is to make you spend money with me. Now, it doesn't do me any good if I take your money and don't produce a great product for you, because then you're just not going to be able to pay me and you're not going to stick around as a client. I have to do my part. The interview is very much so two ways. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's all about me or us interviewing you. No, it's a two-way interview. You need to interview us. That is vitally important, that you like us, trust us, and think that we're competent enough to do the job. But we're interviewing you too. And trust is one of the biggest things we're working on here, because it is not cheap to get into contract manufacturing. We've lowered the cost of entry, the barrier of entry here at Craft Cannery, down to where we can get startups up and running for under a couple $1,000s. But I still used the word thousands there, didn't I? I didn't say hundreds. I didn't say $50. You're still looking at a couple grand to really get up and running. So we have to have a level of trust between us before we're going to be able to do business with you. And that's something that I don't know that this was necessarily what I was supposed to talk about for this bullet point, but it's kind of where my head went, because I do think it's really interesting to think about business relationships, especially when it's, you know, people are so used to dealing in a B2C world, business to consumer. They're so used to being the customer. Customer's always right. They're not used to B2B. Business to business isn't like that. It's not a customer's always right world. It's a relationship world. So anyway, more inside the industry. Two more bullet points here. SQF, HACCP, and FSMA. navigating food safety certifications. Yeah, this is a big mystique, too, that I know a lot of people, I had all these questions as well. A lot of people ask these questions of me, and that is, what certifications do you even have to be able to produce? Like, what are the rules? What are the laws? I'll tell you exactly. So, at the bare minimum, if you're going to do a shelf-stable formulated acid or acidified product, you need to be registered with the New York State Department of Agriculture. A lot of people call them Ags and Markets for short. Ags and Markets do a lot of inspecting around. They're really inspecting anyone who's doing anything resembling manufacturing, from tiny, tiny to big, big. And they're just looking that you are doing your critical, that you are hitting your critical limits on everything you're producing. So what does that mean, critical limits? Well, on Guglielmo marinara sauce, the critical limits are as follows. The pH of the final product, the acidity, must be below a 4.2. The sauce must be cooked to 195 degrees and held at that temperature for 6 minutes. It must be filled into the bottles at 195 degrees or higher, and then sealed and inverted for at least 2 minutes. Inverted, inversion. Not tilted over. What am I trying to say? Flipped upside down to sanitize the bottom of the lid. Must be held for 6 minutes prior to forced cooling as well. And must achieve a vacuum seal. The lid has to be on, right? That's what Ags and Markets is looking for. Basics, 101. Next level up, you've got a couple of things depending on what world you're going into, but you've got HACCP and FSMA. HACCP, H-A-C-C-P. Hazard analysis, critical control points. It's really intimidating until you break down what it actually is. A HACCP plan is difficult to write. There's a lot of ins and outs out of it. A lot of people hire consultants and pay $10,000 to write a HACCP plan. I'm here to tell you a HACCP plan is basically like this. And by the way, the Ags and Markets, that's like you got your high school diploma in manufacturing, right? This next level, HACCP and FSMA, this is like you've gotten your college degree in food manufacturing. Not all plants are required to have these, but if you're doing a certain amount of business and it's a financial number, this is this podcast all about transparency, right? I'll tell you what it is. For the longest time, it was $1 million. I think they've actually recently raised it to $1.2 million. But once you hit $1.2 million, you have to follow FSMA. HACCP is only required by like the USDA and SQF, which we'll get into in a little while. But HACCP and FSMA are really closely related. They're very similar to each other. Long story short, HACCP is this. Hazard analysis. Think about the entire lifeline of something that comes into your building. A raw material, a single tomato comes into your building. And every portion of the process from being received into the warehouse, stored, prepared for cooking, cooked, put into a finished product, and that finished product now leaving the building and making it to its destination safely. Think about that entire process and where the hazards, where the problems could be in that process, how severe those hazards are, and what your plan is to mitigate the risks, to get around the hazards, to make sure that the hazards don't occur, that everything stays safe. Right? That's HACCP. Really 30,000-foot view of HACCP. It gets way more complicated than that. But that's sort of the general idea of what the hell is a HACCP plan. Really detailed explanation of what's going on in your plant and how are you mitigating risk. FSMA, F-S-M-A, that's the Food Safety Modernization Act. Really similar to HACCP, but it's got a whole bunch of other stuff too. FSMA's got stuff like food fraud, food defense. What are these things? Well, food fraud is like lying about what's in a product. A really famous example of this would be when Italy was sending over extra virgin olive oil that wasn't actually extra virgin olive oil. It was being diluted with and cut with cheaper oils. Really good example of that, right? Food defense is how do I make sure that all the products that we're making in our plant are defended against somebody from the outside coming in and doing something to tamper with them? UPS driver comes in. He's pissed off. sees that we're making Guglielmo's marinara. He doesn't like Guglielmo's marinara, so he's going to tamper with the ingredients, right? What are we doing to make sure that never happens? That's food defense. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff with FSMA. And you're talking about, you know, pest control. You're talking about waste management. You're talking about chemical. You have to have a chemical program in place. A lot of different things. But the truth is, years ago, these things didn't exist. And it was really more up on the plants to just kind of come up with their own plans. Now, to a certain extent, it still is up to plants to come up with their own plans. But what's interesting to me is that at least they've set some guidelines for you. And somebody starting a business like mine, I start a food manufacturing business having no idea what I'm doing. And they outline for me a bit of a roadmap of here's how you can do what it is that you're trying to do. A lot of businesses wouldn't have that. You know, they don't have a built, you know, there's not a program you can go to that's just a built-in, like, here's how to build a program. Here's how to build some processes. Here's who you need to hire. Food manufacturing kind of has that outlined, which is nice once you get into these things. The final one I'll talk about. So we said eggs and markets, that's like a high school diploma, right? HACCP and FSMA, that's like getting a college degree. The last one I'll talk about, and I would call this, is like getting a master's degree. Is SQF, Safe Quality Food. SQF is just one of many different certifications you can get under something bigger called the Global Food Safety, what is it called? GFSI, Global Food Safety Initiative. That's what it is. So it's really a GFSI certificate of some kind or certification. I'm oversimplifying here. I called it the master's degree. There are even doctorate levels you can do of GFSI and other certifications. You can go further. There's, you know, you can get certified in organic and kosher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in general, a general sort of just food manufacturing master's degree would be getting a certification in a GFSI thing. And I'll speak to SQF because that's what we have here. And SQF is going to take everything Eggs and Markets is worried about, everything HACCP is worried about, everything FSMA is worried about, and then add a whole bunch of extra stuff on top of that. So the good news is when you start going down the road of SQF, if you've done HACCP and FSMA already, you're probably, well, I'm getting really in the weeds here, I'm sorry, but you're probably in really good shape. But SQF is going to go even further. It's going to have you doing microbiology around your plant. You're swabbing kettles. You're swabbing fillers. You're making sure that you have, you're swabbing your drains for Listeria, E. coli, right? You're swabbing your employees' hands. You're instituting GMP, good manufacturing practices, although actually that came back with FSMA and HACCP, but they're really rounding out all of the cracks that could still exist after FSMA and HACCP and making sure that you are running a tight ship, ultimately, geared toward food safety. Now, I will say this, what SQF does better than Eggs and Markets, better than HACCP, better than FSMA, is that it also worries about quality, because number one priority is always going to be safety. All those other certifications, they just worry about safety. SQF's the first one who comes in and says, we also want to make sure you're making good products, quality products, and here's a bunch of programs you need to have in place to ensure that. That's an audit, and that costs something. See, HACCP, FSMA, Eggs and Markets, USDA, that's taxpayer money. That's government entity. SQF is private business. You're paying for them to come in and give you a third-party audit. But that audit, that third-party audit certificate, is how you get a lot of business with larger brands, regional brands, things like that. All right, final topic, the true cost of making a jar of sauce. It says, break down the costs, ingredients, labor, compliance, etc., and show where margin lives. Yeah, listen, this is probably not something that I have to tell you, but a lot of folks look at a jar of sauce. They see a glass jar, a cap, a label, tomatoes, basil, parsley, oregano, onion, garlic, and they say, why does that thing cost $6? I could make that for $2. Okay, maybe. But you know that SQF audit I was just telling you about? That's $7,000. That costs us $7,000 a year to get audited. You have to have employees. You have to have labor. You got to keep the lights on, pay an electric bill. Do you have a landlord? If not, do you have a mortgage? Mm-hmm. What about the pest control company? What about the waste management? What about the groundskeeping? Got to get your lawn mowed, don't you? Right? Got to buy all of the infrastructure, the equipment. Got to continue to pay to have that maintenance. What about when something goes down? You got to pay to have that repaired, right? What about the heat in the building, the air conditioning, HVAC, for example? Did I mention labor yet? Oh, labor, huge piece of that as well. Got to have your taxes done every year, right? Got to pay the accountant. What about your bookkeep? Got to get your bookkeeping done. Do your own bookkeeping? Yeah, I did my own bookkeeping till it got way out of hand. Now I have a bookkeeper, okay? Got a lobby. Got to have furniture for the lobby. What about a break room for the employee? What about bathrooms? Toilet. Got to buy toilet paper for the bathrooms, right? Need a maintenance shop. Need extra pieces and parts for the entire plant because the entire plant has pieces and parts that will eventually wear down and break, and we cannot afford to be down. So we need to have replacements on hand. So buy 2, 3, 4 of everything. Did I mention labor yet? Labor is a big piece. What about equipment? You need a forklift. You need a pallet jack. What about all those, speaking of pallet jacks, what about all the pallets? What about computers for your employees to do their work on? I could go on and on and on. There is a ton of over. Did I mention labor? Did I ever talk about labor? There is a ton of overhead and labor cost. And then really what most food manufacturing plants are trying to do, well, I should say most businesses are trying to do, is you're just trying to do the volume to keep the overhead cost, I'll call it overhead cost per jar, down as low as you can. Let's say, to make the math easy, that it costs $1,000 for me to open my doors every day, and we produce 1,000 bottles. That means I have $1 per bottle in overhead costs that I need to cover. So now you've got your jar, your label, your lid, your tomatoes, garlic, onion, basil, parsley, oregano, green, bell pepper, olive oil, plus you've got the dollar per jar on top of that, that you need to make sure that you're covering your overhead. Otherwise, you're just eating your below-the-line costs. Now, you creep in with a little word called profit. Up until then, you could do it for that price and just break even. Or maybe you actually want to get paid. This is your opportunity to maybe get paid. So what do you do next? You want to get paid? Easy enough to get paid. Here's how you do it. You add in cost, or you add in labor. You add in a margin. You add in overhead. Let's talk about margin. Where do you want your margin to be? Good question. A lot of debate over this. A lot of companies, almost all of them, will tell you they don't get enough margin. That's true. Everybody's always fighting for more margin. I shouldn't say fighting. Fighting's not the right word, but a jar of sauce that leaves this factory ends up on the shelf for a couple dollars more than it costs us to produce. That's true, because everyone needs to make money off of it, because that's business. That's how it works. That's how we feed our families. So you've got your cost, you've got your overhead, you've got your labor, then you've got your own profit margin. Now you got to give it to somebody to get it from your facility to the facility where it will be sold, to the store where it will be sold. That person's going to take a cut. Now the store where it's being sold is going to put it on the shelf at a markup. That person's taking a cut. They're getting a margin. So by the time you make a $3 jar of product, you probably are going to see it on the shelf for $6. I would say, it's a good question. Well, what does everybody want to get for margin? My experience, distributors want 20 to 25%. Retailers, depending on what it is, they're kind of all over the place with desired margins in retail, depending on the category. But my experience, you know, I don't know. Maybe they want anywhere between 25 and 40%. So if you can start to kind of reverse engineer and figure back profit margins in that way, but that's, and by the way, those are all very fair. Those are all very fair numbers. Nobody's getting rich off of selling one thing. Everybody in food knows it's a volume game. Restaurants too. Food manufacturing and restaurants. I love to think that we're in the same family. We are, but we're distant cousins, very distant cousins. But we do have that one thing in common. It is all about volume. All about volume. All right. Well, listen, I think we did it, right? ChatGPT wrote my podcast script for me for the second week in a row. I hope it was okay. I do appreciate you listening. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a great week.
I'm Chris Lindstrom, the host of the Food About Town podcast. If you want to learn more about the Rochester food and drink scene and beyond, with a good dose of nerdery and personal stories on top, then Food About Town is for you. I've been writing and podcasting for over 10 years, and I'm so thankful for all the support from the community. Subscribe to the Food About Town podcast today and hear from the people that make and love the food and beverages you can't stop enjoying.
Welcome to Behind the Studio Door, where we dig into the vibrant creative landscape of Rochester, New York. Hi, I'm Molly Darling, and along with my co-host Christian Rivera and our fabulous producer Chris Lindstrom, it's my pleasure to guide you through the dynamic world of our local creative professionals. Each episode offers a unique glimpse into the studios of those who enrich our Rochester community with their artistic vision. Join us as we explore the diversity and talent in Rochester, revealing the compelling narratives and creative journeys that exist just beyond the studio door.
This has been a presentation of the Lunch Hour Podcast Network.